Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Tuesday, November 1st, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by Knesset reporter Carrie Keller-Lynn and U.S. correspondent Luke Tress. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. So it is election day for Israel's 25th Knesset. What are we going to talk about this morning? Carrie will lead us off with five factors that could shift this election, Israel's fifth in 4 years. We'll also talk about President Isaac Herzog's White House visit last week and a steep admission of fraud, of guilt from a major Brooklyn yeshiva. Carrie, let's get started with you on this election day morning. So tell us about the very five factors that could swing this government from Likud to Yesh Atid, perhaps Benny Gantz's National Unity Party. What is going to happen here, or at least what are the factors that could move things in one direction or another?
Well, Jess, I'll take a step back. I'll say that this election, much to everyone's consternation, has consistently polled to be at a deadlock. Israeli voters are frustrated. Politicians are scrambling. If this fifth election since 2019 also fails to produce a stable government, I think there'll be a lot of disappointment. So let's look at a couple of factors that could break this predicted stalemate. Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, even though it leads, only has 60 seats. One away from the majority needed to secure a government. On the other hand, we have Prime Minister Yair Lapid, whose bloc has been polling up to 56, not enough to secure a government, but perhaps enough to block Netanyahu from forming one. And remember, in the middle of the two, there's this wedge of Arab votes, of Arab seats, that would be represented by the Chadash Tal party as long as it makes its way into Knesset. If it does not, that is one of the scenarios where a map could be changed. So one scenario which Chadash Tal doesn't make it in is if Arab turnout remains as low as it is predicted to be. Arab turnout dropped precipitously last election. It went down to about 44%, and it's polling somewhere between 37 and 48, making 44 smack the middle of that again. This is relevant because the Arab community makes up about 17% of Israel's nearly 6.8 million eligible voters. And without high turnout from that community, two parties might be threatened, both Chadash Tal, which sits in that kind of non-aligned wedge, as well as the Islamist party Ram, which would sit with Lapid's bloc. And so with those two shifting in and out of the Knesset, we can see how the blocs can change. Similarly, Haredi voters are polling to reduce their turnout by about 12%, which is quite significant given that the group is the highest turning out demographic among Israeli voters. If turnout decreases there, we might see also UTJ, the Ashkenazi Haredi party, losing a seat and perhaps also changing the map in terms of taking power away from Netanyahu's bloc. Similarly, we just talked about parties that can and can't cross thresholds. There are two more parties on the left who have a threshold problem. That is Meretz and Labor. They spent a good part of yesterday convincing voters to come out and vote for them so that they can definitely make their way into Knesset. Meretz has said that it's lost something like 17,000 potential votes in the last week, which is something like half a seat, which is incredibly consequential for a party that's skirting that electoral threshold to make it in. Ayelet Shaked, who runs Jewish Home, is another factor in this election. Her former party, Yamina, collapsed. It went from being the ruling party to a party that's not even on this year's election ballot. And then the last point is the weather. If the weather turns out to be raining, Israelis seem to be unable to deal with anything that is 80 and sunny, we actually might see voter turnout decrease because rain might play a factor in this election. As crazy as it sounds, pundits say that might play a role.
And then there's, of course, the fact that I feel like I speak to people of a certain age and they say, I'm just not going to vote. I'm done with voting.
I'm hearing quite the same. There is so much disaffection going on. People are tired. They're frustrated. And especially with the stalemate polling to be once again the consequence of this election, people are not sufficiently motivated to come out to vote. It really just comes down to turnout. All the factors that I mentioned are ultimately in voters' hands. And so the biggest thing Israelis can do in order to drive a stable government on Tuesday is to go out and actually cast a ballot.
All right. We'll see what happens as the day unfolds. Thank you, Carrie. We're going to take a quick break. And when we're back, Luke will talk to us about President Isaac Herzog's White House visit last week.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, blankie. Their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Luke, tell us what President Isaac Herzog spoke about at the White House with U.S. President Biden last week. It sounded like Biden was talking about the maritime deal with Lebanon, between Israel and Lebanon, but Herzog had another subject in mind. What can you tell us about that?
So, yeah, President Herzog was in Washington for 2 days last week. He met Biden, he met Secretary of State Blinken, he met Nancy Pelosi, some Jewish leaders, some other officials. Overall, a really successful trip, it seemed like. Him and Biden have a really good relationship, as does Herzog and Pelosi and everyone else. It really showed how strong the ties are, as most of these trips go. One issue of difference that kind of came up quietly was that when it comes to the Middle East, Herzog was really focused on Iran, and the U.S. side was really focused on Lebanon. It was a day before the signing of the Israel-Lebanon maritime deal, which was brokered by the U.S. The Biden administration is really happy about it. The U.S. brokered it. Herzog met with Amos Hochstein, who's the envoy who brokered it at the beginning of his visit to Washington. So the Biden administration is really kind of happy about it, bringing it up whenever they can. And in all these meetings, they would bring it up, and Herzog would kind of say, thank you, we appreciate it, but I really want to talk about Iran. He brought photos of Iranian drones being used in Ukraine with him to show the White House, even though they already know that this is happening. It was just kind of making a point that, you know, you can't trust Iran. They're doing bad stuff. He actually didn't even bring those photos to show Biden because he knows they know about it already. And he's really highlighting, Iran is, the U.S. kind of approach to the Middle East worked with Lebanon, this kind of dialogue-focused diplomacy and negotiations. So it worked with Lebanon, but it's not working with Iran. Obviously, Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, which kind of, blew it up in that sense. So who knows what would have happened if they stayed the course. But either way, it's not working. The talks with Iran have stalled. And now there's these new complications, which is Iran is involved in Ukraine on the side of Russia. And it's also cracking down on human rights protesters inside Iran, which the U.S. is also not happy about. So the U.S. is really struggling on this and didn't really seem like they wanted to talk about it. An Israeli official told us after some of the meetings that the U.S. is just really disappointed with the whole approach to Iran. They feel like there's no one to talk to, no one to trust on the Iranian side, which the State Department denied. But they've kind of said the same things themselves, that they're just not thinking about negotiations or the JCPOA right now. That was a big theme of Herzog's visit.
Given that Herzog's role is essentially ceremonial, what does it actually mean? In other words, what were pundits saying? What does it mean about the fact that Herzog is going in there, bringing up a different subject than what the U.S. president, what Biden wanted to speak about or wanted to focus on?
I think it just shows both sides' priorities. So yeah, Herzog as president, it's more of a symbolic and ceremonial role, but he is influential. He is playing an active role as a diplomat for Israel. So I think it's just kind of showing off, like, the U.S. wants to highlight their approach to the Middle East and that it worked with Lebanon. And Israel is appreciative of that, but they're still really focused on Iran, which is a much bigger issue for them. And that's, I think, not directly saying like the U.S. way isn't working, but kind of getting the message across that Iran, from Israel's perspective, is a bad actor and can't be trusted. One other thing that was kind of quietly coming up was, I think, some trepidation from Israel about the elections. Herzog in, I think, every meeting, every public statement, he was saying, we have elections coming up in Israel. The U.S. has midterms coming up. But he kept saying, whatever happens in these elections, we need to respect each other's democracy and we need to keep our close bonds intact, no matter what happens politically. And he kept saying both sides are having elections, and, you know, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich did not come up, but it seemed like that's really what he was talking about, trying to kind of calm the waters before maybe these far right lawmakers come into power in Israel. And a couple Democratic congressmen have kind of warned Israel over Ben-Gvir, some Jewish leaders in the U.S. So there's some tension there, and Herzog, and he actually made the same statement today to the Jewish federations. So in his role as kind of a diplomat, like president slash, you know, kind of doing these diplomatic activities, he's really trying to, I think, kind of calm the waters before possibly Ben-Gvir and Smotrich come into power in Israel.
Doing what he can. You also covered the story about an admission of guilt and a penalty of $5 million, a total of $8 million in penalties, from New York's largest Hasidic yeshiva over its misappropriation of funds. So tell us about that, and I'm just wondering what that actually means in the scope of New York's yeshiva system and the greater scrutiny that it's been facing and that you've been actually writing about for the last bunch of months.
So the Central United Talmudical Academy in Williamsburg, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn, it's the main home of the Satmar movement, which is one of the biggest or the biggest Hasidic movements in New York. It acknowledged defrauding the government of over $3 million last week, part of a plea deal where they get to continue operating, but they put steps in place and they pay back more than this $3 million plus $5 million in penalties. So they're paying over $8 million total. They basically admitted to a range of fraudulent activities. The main one was collecting federal benefits to feed needy children and misappropriating them. I think it was $3.2 million. So they have after-school programs, and they were getting funding to feed the kids, and they were either using it for other stuff, like the FBI, the prosecutor said they were using it for adult parties for adults. Like, per the federal guidelines, you're supposed to give nutritious, good meals, and they were kind of giving them bad meals. So it's like over $3 million. And this took place in 2014 and 2015. A bunch of other stuff like tax benefits, frauds, like hiding salaries to employees, paying them in cash and vouchers so they could claim benefits, some of which they cashed in with the school themselves. So there was just this like wide range of misdoing by this school. And the FBI, federal prosecutors, like, it became a big case. And they have acknowledged it to their credit, and they're taking steps to do better now, I guess, and they will continue operating.
But what will that mean, in your opinion, in terms of this larger issue of New York's yeshiva system receiving federal funding, and then will there be greater scrutiny from what you've been seeing?
Yeah, so this plays into this kind of bigger issue of yeshivas in New York. There's just been a series of things that have increased pressure on them. One is the New York Times has been really aggressively reporting on them, including with this issue, which has really infuriated a lot of people in the community who feel like they're being unfairly targeted. The state passed new guidelines that will require yeshivas to give more secular education, which was also a huge controversy. Earlier this month, a yeshiva was found to be violating the law because it wasn't giving enough secular education, which was the first time that happened. And then this case. So like this case, this is the first one where it was like really illegal conduct by one of these yeshivas, like the first really legal consequences. Everything else, it was kind of they were not giving enough secular education and they were taking public funding, but it was all by the books before this. So this case is a little bit different from the other controversies, but it adds to this picture of the yeshivas are under attack. And one reason why this is a big issue right now is there are New York governor's election coming up. So the yeshivas and crime are really big issues for the Haredi community. And a lot of them are really rallying behind Lee Zeldin, who's the Republican candidate for governor, who's kind of said, like, I'll fix the crime problem and I'll let the yeshivas do what they want. Kathy Hochul, who's been in power, has not been part of this crackdown on yeshivas. She's kind of stayed away from it. And she's been a really good friend to the Jewish community for a long time. But I think a lot of community members kind of feel like this crackdown is happening under her watch. And it's pushing a lot of people to Zeldin. And it's a tight race. So it could have big political implications.
All right. We'll keep on following that. Thanks, Luke. Okay, so we're going to close out today's daily briefing. We'll see what happens over the course of this election day. And I thank you, Luke, and you, Carrie, for being with me today.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks so much, Jess. And if you're in Israel, please go vote.
Right. And we'll be back tomorrow, obviously, talking about the results of this election day. Thanks very much. Have a good day and a good listen.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.